This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
If I do my job perfectly, I will probably kill you.
That's Shep Gordon. His job is managing musicians and chefs, turning them into stars. His clients want to be famous, but Gordon's learned that fame can kill. After intentionally staying out of the spotlight himself throughout his career, Gordon is now the subject of a new documentary directed by Mike Myers called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. Mike Myers wrote and starred in the Austin Powers movies and Wayne's World and was the voice of Shrek. He was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 1989 to 95. Shep Gordon not only managed the career of Alice Cooper, he was instrumental in creating the persona and dreaming up some of the stage antics that made Alice famous. Gordon also managed Anne Murray, Blondie, Teddy Pendergrass, Luther Vandross, and briefly George Clinton. He's often credited with creating the recent celebrity chef phenomenon. Mike Myers and Shep Gordon have been friends for about 22 years. Terry spoke with them earlier this week.
Mike Myers, Shep Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air. Mike, let's start with you. How did you meet Shep Gordon?
I met Shep Gordon in 1992 on the set of Wayne's World. Shep Gordon, of course, is Alice Cooper's manager. And I wanted Alice Cooper to be in the film. And my two favorite songs were 18 and School's Out. Now, I had never even been in a film, let alone, like, written or being, like, one of the guys in the film. And Lauren said, well, you know, there's a little bit of a problem. You have to talk to his manager, Shep Gordon. I'm going, oh, okay. And so now I'm talking to this huge, legendary rock and roll manager, and he says, I've got some bad news for you. We're not going to do 18 again, and we're not doing School's Out. We're going to do something from the new album. And I was like, oh, no. I didn't know what to do. Now, Shep had like a ponytail, and he was wearing a satin tour jacket. And I didn't know what to do. And I said, well, I don't want to do that. And he said, well, I happen to know you start filming in 2 weeks. You don't have a choice. And he goes, you know, this song, I would hate for you to say no to this song and not have heard this song. And he played it, and I liked it. It was a song called Feed My Frankenstein. And I said, but, you know, that's not what I wanted in the script. You know, I didn't know nothing. I'm an idiot from Toronto. He said, I also happen to know this, that Alice will be on stage for approximately 8 seconds. And if you put School's Out in the end credits, people are going to think that's the song that he sang. And everyone thinks that that's the song he sang. He was absolutely right. Years later, I'm in Maui. The movie came out, and it was a hit, like a big hit. I had no idea. I didn't even know what a hit would look like. And so somebody told me you have to stay in a hotel with an assumed name. I had an assumed name, like a fake name. And only my brother Paul would call through. Phone rings, and I go, hey, Paul. And it's like, it's Shep Gordon. I understand you're in Hawaii, where Shep lives. I go, how did you get my number? He goes, it's Hawaii. He goes, do you want to go to a luau with Sylvester Stallone and Arnold? First of all, Arnold, not Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnold and Whoopi. And I yeah, of course. So I went, and we become fast friends.
So Shep Gordon, let me get to you. The movie starts, Supermensch starts, with a clip that we just heard where you say, if I do my job well, it will kill you, that's what you tell your new clients. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think fame is, you know, in some ways it's fool's gold. I think Mike really describes it the best of anyone I've heard. He calls it a toxic waste product of fame. And it truly is, you know. It's
the toxic, I always say it's the industrial disease of creativity. Yeah. Like, you want to make stuff, which is fantastic, and then this thing happens, which is very gratifying, and I'm very grateful for it. But it does require a hazmat suit, a psychic hazmat suit.
I had an interesting moment because I've never had to deal with fame. I have only had to talk about it and try and protect people who are famous, and that's very different than living that moment until, you know, there's those old sayings, until you walk in the shoes, you don't really know the walk. And I have no true experience, but I had one moment during this process that really opened my eyes. I was walking to a meeting at the Algonquin Hotel, And I was doing what normal human beings do when they walk. They're in their own mind. They're thinking. They're maybe looking at stuff. They're maybe singing a song. But they're walking their path. And a girl I heard say, "Are you Shep? Are you Shep Gordon?" And I said, "I am." She said, "Oh, I work at CNN, and I just saw the movie at a screening." And when I was a child, I had some problems with my family, and I'd really love to talk to you about how you overcame those feelings and were successful. And I looked at my watch, and I had to go to the Algonquin. And I really wanted to be compassionate with this person, and I had to dish her. And it made me think about all those years I've spent protecting people from people like her, making sure they couldn't ask the question, never really thinking about what is the karmic price that the person in the middle who you're blocking for really feels. Because on some level, even if it's not conscious, they have to feel that love coming at them from people and not being able to answer it. It's really hard to stay compassionate. And I only had it for a second. So those are hard things. Those are things that fame bring that have no intrinsic value.
That's a really interesting point that you just made, that if you're famous and everybody wants to talk to you or confess to you or just be near you, it's hard to be compassionate because it's mathematically impossible to allow everybody to have that access to you.
How many times I've been with Alice where someone told them about the first concert they went to and they had to sneak out of their house, and they love telling them the story. It makes them feel good. It brings back memories. You don't want to cut them off, but Alice could hear that 24 hours a day and never be able to have a thought in his mind.
Yeah.
So he needs someone like me who protects him, but there's a price you pay.
You didn't grow up with the idea of like, and then I'll be a manager and manage all these music stars and celebrity chefs. You kind of happened into it. Your first career lasted, it sounds like, about 24 hours.
Yeah, a little less.
A little less, yeah. As a parole officer in a youth detention center just outside of L.A., and as the movie tells the story, you know, after you failed at that immediately, you go to L.A., you stop at this hotel, and at the hotel are people like Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix. And what I think I understood from the movie is that basically you had a lot of marijuana with you and you were selling the marijuana. And it was through selling a lot of marijuana that you kind of became people's not only dealer but also their manager. Do I have that right? Did I interpret that correctly?
Well, close. You have the pieces right. I had a fairly good business as a dealer to the celebrities in the hotel who were users. And they felt that I needed to have a legitimate business in where the Chambers brothers and Jimi Hendrix came from, the ghettos. If you had a new watch on, you had to tell the police, where'd you get the watch? Long Island, nobody asked or cared. So I never really thought about that. So Jimmy said one day, what's your real job? And I don't really have a job. And he said, you Jewish? And in my background, when someone asks you that question, you start running. But I knew he was faster than me, so I just sort of said, yeah, I am, and had no idea that that would be the luckiest moment of my life. Because, you know, you're Jewish, you should be a manager. Because I guess, you know, all the studios, all the agencies were all notoriously run by Jews who didn't have the greatest reputations, but nonetheless, that's what they did. And as Alice tells it, Willie Chambers or Lester Chambers came over. Alice Cooper was living in their house and said, we found a Jew that'll manage it. I think he might pay you also. And I was willing to pay him because it was a front. So they were a business expense.
Wait, so who did you pay so that you can manage them?
I paid
Cooper?
Alice $10 a week
hysterical.
I was his manager.
When I interviewed Alice Cooper in 2007, I was really surprised and pleased at how aware he was of constructing the persona of Alice Cooper and how he saw it as a vaudeville act. And within the interview, he, of course, credited you as well, you know, for creating the whole Alice Cooper persona. And having seen the movie about you, Shep Gordon, the movie Supermensch, now I really understand exactly how that was constructed, the Alice Cooper persona, and how much you contributed to that. And you knew that the way to get attention was to be seen as a rock act that was dangerous and that adults really hated and that therefore young people could really embrace. So
I would say new is maybe too strong a word. Hoped
would
probably be a much better word.
So what's an example of one of your favorite things that you did to make Alice Cooper seem dangerous?
I think everything we did, you have to remember the times. We're talking now about the early 70s, late 60s. So first think about a man named Alice. That was very, very, very bold. There was nothing like that on the landscape. Then think about a man named Alice in makeup and dresses. That's way bolder. Then think about that person who could be your neighbor next door. It could be a 60-year-old widow named Alice Cooper wearing that dress, chopping up a baby doll on stage and having snakes and eating chickens. So everything we did went to that point. I would say the highlight of his career was the chicken incident because it really revolted everybody. There was nobody who wanted anyone to ever kill a chicken.
Okay, so
as Alice says, why don't they pick on Colonel Sanders? I only killed one chicken.
Shep Gordon, you've used the word vaudeville to describe Alice Cooper's act. And Alice Cooper has used that word to describe his act. Groucho Marx had used that word to describe Alice Cooper's act. He became a fan. You ended up managing Groucho Marx in his final years. Mike Myers, when you as an Alice Cooper fan, realized that, oh, this is such a constructed act. It is kind of vaudeville. You know, Shep Gordon is kind of, you know, writing the act. Did that make you like Alice Cooper even more, or did you feel like betrayed, like, oh, it's not authentic?
Oh, I liked him even more. See, I loved the theatricality of it. I knew it to be the burlesque of violence. You know what I'm saying? A filmmaker that I worship is Quentin Tarantino.
And you were in Inglourious Basterds.
I was in Inglourious Basterds. I got the call one day. I thought it was my brother Paul, who does fantastic voices. And it was like Tarantino. And I'm like, yeah, can I help you? He goes, yeah, I'm doing a film about Hitler gets killed. Do you want to play a British general explaining the mission? And I was like, am I being punked? Of course I want to play a British general. Are you kidding? Both my parents were in, my mom was in the Royal Air Force. My dad was in the Royal Engineers. I'm totally in. So I went back, just because I love his films, and I looked at all of the films, and I just thought, you know, there are certain people who should be allowed to do Grand Guignol because they take it to such a fantastic, absurd level. Alice Cooper is one of them, you know?
I want you to tell, Shep Gordon, I want you to tell a little bit of the Anne Murray story. She's just so the opposite of Alice Cooper. She's, you know, a pop singer who has a kind of, you know, middle-of-the-road-ish sensibility, her most famous recording, Snowbird. So what was your plan to make her famous?
I was managing Alice. We were getting successful. None of us knew why. I had opportunities to expand my management business, but I had no idea if I was a manager. There wasn't a rule book. There wasn't a handbook. And I thought let me go as far away as I possibly can. When I was in Toronto with John Lennon, I had met a producer named Brian Ahern who had just cut a song called Snowbird with Anne Murray. She was a gym teacher from, I believe, Nova Scotia, and she worked on a summer TV show. And it was a good challenge because it was the opposite of Alice. It was a pure singer. There were no frills, no story, no anything. It was as unblemished as you could possibly get, unmanufactured. And it worked. We got her some pictures with John Lennon and Alice, and she had a great voice. And
set that up. You made it.
I did, yeah.
You invited John Lennon and other people to be
Alice
at the club where she was performing. Yeah.
Alice had a group called the Hollywood Vampires who met at the Rainbow Bar and Grill. And
but by the way, Shep, when you say a group, you mean a drinking club.
A drinking club. Yes. A drinking club. Very, very heavy drinking club. It was Alice, John Lennon, Keith Moon, Harry Nilsson, all of whom knew how to drink, Mickey Dolenz, and Bernie Taupin. And they met at the Rainbow every night and would get as drunk as they could. And Keith Moon would come dressed as a nurse one night, as a Nazi general the next night, as a chauffeur the next night. It was insane. And I went over and I begged them to come see Anne Murray at the Troubadour for a picture. And I think I ended up having to drive each of them for the next 3 or 4 months. I was their designated driver, but they came over, took a picture, and that picture went everywhere.
Let's talk about Teddy Pendergrass a little bit, because you started managing him after he went solo following his time with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. And you tell this great story about how he performed and one night when you started managing him and didn't get paid, and it was really hard for you to collect the money, and you were kind of shocked by this. Would you tell the story?
Yeah, there was a circuit, as I later found out, called the Chitlin Circuit, which is pretty famous in the world of R&B and black music. And it was a circuit of clubs and arenas in the major markets of America that were, for the most part, owned by the radio station in the city or had some relationship with the radio station. And black artists would go into these rooms and play. The record company would set it up. They wouldn't get paid, but they thought that was the only way they could get the radio station to play their song, was to play the club. I'm sure it was a form of payola that someone figured out. There was no money exchanging hands, so the government couldn't bust them or something. But what happened was this mentality of accepting the fact that they weren't getting paid. And that didn't work for me. And Teddy was very big at the time, and he was, you know, he took a real chance. He trusted me, and we went out to break the circuit, and it was scary. This movie is 90 minutes, so you can't tell everything. Right. But the night at the Roxy that we talked about, there were death threats by him. The FBI was everywhere around the place. It was the first time we played at Whitehall. And the first time we said we were going to break this Chitlin circuit. And it was scary, but we got through.
Why were there death threats? Where were they coming from?
A lot of people made a lot of money off the Chitlin circuit. It was very big business, and it was not, it was a time of gangsterism in the music business. A lot of Italian mob, a lot of Afro-American mob. A lot of people went to jail during that era for a lot of stuff that wasn't friendly. And and this was big business. I mean, you know, we sold out Radio City Music Hall. We had probably 1,000 pickets outside. There were organized pickets against there was no legitimate reason for a black man not to play Radio City Music Hall except that he was getting paid.
What did the picket sign say?
Union unfair, I don't even remember. I'm sure there's pictures of it, but it was
completely trumped up.
Yeah, completely trumped up, but it was big business. This was, you know, the Chitlin Circuit was very big business. I think fairly well documented, and it was a couple of acts. I remember Earth, Wind, and Fire came in right on the back of us and started playing places like Madison Square Garden, Donna Summer. There was we weren't the only ones to break, but I think Teddy was the first one to really stand up. His past manager had been shot to death, so he had a position to he had a strong platform to speak from.
In 1982, when Teddy Pendergrass was in a car accident and became quadriplegic, you were the one who had to tell him that he was paralyzed and would never walk again. Why were you the one who had to deliver that news?
You know, that's my memory, and as a movie shows, sometimes my memory is jaded, so I don't want to write in stone 100%. My memory of it is I got off the elevator. He had nobody significant in his life at that time. His mother was very old, but he didn't have a wife. The children were too young, and it was a very tough thing to tell somebody, and I was sort of the father figure, manager. I was more than just manager in Teddy's life. We had our lives threatened. When your life is threatened with someone, you go to a different place. Mm-hmm. When you get through it, mm-hmm. It's almost like soldiers in a battlefield. You can't describe what that bond is, but there's a bond that's different than a manager-client bond, and we had that. I remember I told him, and then we went right to his house and started listening. I said to his mother, and we got to go out to the house and find tapes that haven't been released, because we're going to need money. And he had spent every dime he had. And we went from the hospital to the house and found some songs that had never been released that was sitting around the living room, and then tracked it out, and that's got the record out. Mm. But it was not my favorite moment.
Now, some managers are famous, and I'm thinking about Ari Emanuel and Entourage, the show that's kind of loosely based on him. I'm sure you would have had that opportunity if you wanted it, to be a name like that. You know, you are so not famous outside of that world. You don't have a Wikipedia entry. In fact, when I found out you didn't have a Wikipedia entry, my first reaction was, oh no, the film's actually a mockumentary and not a real documentary. The whole thing's made up. I actually made sure that there were other sources earlier on that cited you. I checked you out on my interview with Alice Cooper, and he'd mentioned you, and I thought, like, phew, okay, it's not a mention. This guy's real.
Yeah, I think my job is accomplished much better if I'm invisible. Mm-hmm. I in a compassionate way, I don't mean this in a degrading way, but I always thought of myself as a puppeteer, but in a good way. But always, you know, you don't want to see the puppeteer. It takes away from the power of the performance. That was always, I felt my job was to not... was great for, you know, I never wanted to be in the pictures. I never wanted to be in, you know, it's funny because there are moments now, having gone through this, where I wish I had taken a picture with Salvador Dali. Mm. And I went way out of my way not to.
So imagine, like, doing a documentary on somebody who's one of the most famous people that nobody knows. he's show business famous, famous to the famous. And having virtually no photographs of him with any of these people. And I'm like, dude, a Polaroid?
Something.
A court reporter sketch? You know, help me out, people. But we did find stuff, yeah. You know. Yeah, we had great
researchers.
You did
an amazing job. Mike did an amazing job.
And our editor, yeah. Joe Krings, is fantastic. Yeah. Just a genius. So that we truffle pigged you out, dude, and found stuff.
Yeah,
we
really
hunted you down like the animal you
stuff
are.
Stuff I had never seen.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that Mike Myers making this movie about his dear friend Shep Gordon did not hurt the friendship.
Strengthened it if it could get stronger. I don't know if it can get stronger, but no. If anything, strengthened.
No, I love Shep going into this, and then as I came to know more and more about him, I love him even more, and... Yeah, he's a friend of the family. Like he's, you know, when my daughter Sunday was born, I was just thinking, oh, geez, I wonder when Shep's coming to town.
For me, to entrust my life to someone is way beyond even friendship. And I didn't see it till Mike finished it, but I knew it would be what it should be.
Shep Gordon is the subject of Supermensch, the new documentary by Mike Myers. You'll find the longer version of the interview Terry recorded with Mike Myers and Shep Gordon on our website, freshair.npr.org. We've put a man on the moon, harnessed the atom, and built supercomputers that handle quadrillions of calculations per second. But try to get five people with telephones talking to each other, and we can be quickly exposed as technical klutzes. Fresh Air Tech contributor Alexis Madrigal considers the conference call and how our communication with coworkers has changed.
Every day at 6:30 a.m., I join a conference call with colleagues on the East Coast. I call an 800 number, then enter a six-digit conference room number, then a PIN number. And despite the group remaining largely unchanged, once a week, something goes wrong. When I conference with outsiders, there's a problem every other call. There's the, oops, I got the wrong dial-in problem. There's the, PIN number is too long to remember problem. There's the, is so-and-so on the line problem? And the, someone hasn't muted the line and is a mouth breather problem. Meetings are convened to bring people together, and yet our conference calls prevent communication as often as they enable it. So what's going on? Why hasn't some tech startup fixed this? The key problem with conference calls is that they attempt to connect various telecom networks that have been built on top of the legacy phone network, which is as old as Alexander Graham Bell. We're all trying to hack this nearly century-old system of communication to fit the needs of a world that wants everything to act like the internet. Work and work communication have changed in the gig economy, too. Think about what it actually looks like these days. Some people are calling in via cell phones, others via traditional landlines, still others through the internet. Some in traditional offices, others in cars and coffee shops. And yet we expect everyone to connect smoothly because each can be reached via the 10-digit identifier we call a phone number. In some ways, the conference call for all its foibles is a miracle in interoperability. It's like if you could send a message to an email address, a Twitter user, a Facebook account, and a MySpace page, all with the same tool. The phone system is also not configured to pass along your identity easily. So while we might be able to log into a website using a Facebook account, when we call into a conference, it doesn't tell the other people, "Oh, hey, Alexis just joined from Oakland." Instead, participants have to verbally explain themselves. That might have been okay in the past, but our expectations for these things have changed. On the internet, we are used to our communications being clearly heralded. Now, several startups are trying to change the way that conference calls work. They want to make it easier for people to join calls, know who's on the line, and someday, perhaps, kill the PIN number. Two direct contenders are Uber Conference and Speak, which is spelled with two E's, the latest in a long line of strange spelling decisions by startup companies. Both services do away with PIN numbers if you want to, have full-featured mobile apps, can connect with document-sharing sites like Evernote and Box, and can easily integrate people dialing in from their computers or through Google+. Users can also choose to have the conference service call them on a landline or mobile phone, and of course, if you prefer, you can dial in the old way too. Our virtual meetings, though, don't have to revolve around telephone handsets anymore. As our personal lives go, so do our work lives. We talk less on the phone now and text more because it gets the personal or professional job done. So now most of my work communications actually occur in an instant messaging tool called Slack, which allows us to meet and share ideas without having to pick up the phone. We can paste in links, photos, tweets, and anything else we might want to remember, and it automatically creates an archive and integrates with our calendar tool. Work has changed. It's more important to save our never-ending scroll of ideas than it is to hear the timbre of each other's voices. But if we do need a more sensory experience, Google Hangouts allow for easy and simple video conferencing, providing a much richer interaction than one can get from voice calls alone. And though I think most people think they're a joke, there are so-called telepresence robots like the Vigo, a screen, microphone, camera, and speakers mounted on a tall, wheeled robot. Its maker claims it can see, hear, talk, and move as if you were there. That these other options have not already replaced the traditional conference call is a testament to the one thing that conference calls are good at: interoperability, and not just between technical systems, but also between generations of people. While the youngest people I work with are fluent texters, the oldest prefer face-to-face communications. But we can all meet in the de-technologized zone of the conference call, where one can use the latest Samsung or a rotary dial antiquity, and yet we are all equal in the eyes of the telephone network. And maybe that's worth something. Perhaps even the hassle of having to remember to unmute your line when it's your turn to talk.
Alexis Madrigal is a visiting scholar at Berkeley Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he edits the tech section of their website. Coming up, John Waters tells Terry about his new book, Carsick. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with filmmaker John Waters. He's violated many taboos and created intentionally perverse scenarios in his movies, most notably in Pink Flamingos, which is about a competition for the title The Filthiest Person Alive. His movie Hairspray was adapted into a family-friendly hit Broadway musical, then into a musical film starring John Travolta. A couple of years ago, when Waters was 66, he was looking for an adventure he could write about. He chose to hitchhike cross-country, from his home in Baltimore to his co-op apartment in San Francisco. He chronicles his adventures and frustrations on the road in his new book, Carsick. Parents, note that this interview has a couple of moments that are probably not appropriate for young children.
John Waters, pleasure to have you back on Fresh Air. What made you think of hitchhiking cross-country as the idea for your book?
I don't know. I don't do dating sites. I don't do Facebook. I don't do any of that. I just thought I wanted to meet some new people, and I wanted to have a midlife crisis that didn't involve buying a sports car or doing ridiculous things. So I came up with something more ridiculous, an adventure.
So I used to hitchhike all the time in college. I used to pick up hitchhikers all the time. I never see anyone doing it anymore. I wouldn't dream of picking up a hitchhiker now. What made
well,
you think
I would.
Anyone? You would? Yeah.
Yeah, but the whole time when I hitchhiked across the country, from when I left Baltimore to San Francisco, I saw one hitchhiker. And I was in the car with somebody else, and I said, don't pick him up. I can't believe I did that. You'd think that would be such bad hitchhiking karma. But when you hitchhike alone, you don't want to share your ride with somebody. Believe me. I'm not a communist hitchhiker.
So there's three parts of your book. The first part is fictional stories you imagine that are best case scenarios of what would happen if someone picked you up. And then you have part two, which is fictional stories of what would happen in the worst-case scenarios. And then you have part three, which is what actually happened. One of the best-case scenarios in your book, one of the imagined best-case scenarios in your book, is that you're picked up by your favorite porn star, Johnny Davenport, the star of Power Tool. And he is or was a famous porn star in reality, who in reality did star in Power Tool, one of the great titles.
There's some other good ones, too, but I can't say them. Right.
Yeah, no, exactly. So I imagine you've actually watched a lot of porn films in your time. So what are some
of the... Once I was the judge for the porn Oscars, so they sent cases of them. And
no.
I actually heard another... Yeah, and I heard another judge say, I'm raw from this dude. And the porno Oscars were held in a Howard Johnson's that spun around. So people were like sick, kind of. You know, it would be, have a bunch of drinks at the porn Oscars, and the party was at Howard Johnson's in L.A. that spins. So you kept finding yourself, you had to be like a ballet dancer, make eye contact with one building every time it went around so you wouldn't get the whirlies.
Wait, so is this the real version of the prize that Dirk Diggler wins in Boogie Nights?
Well, there is the AVN Awards. I get AVN, which is the Adult Video News, which is the trade paper for the porn business, which is great. I mean, they have interviews where people says, oh, yes, my mother handles all my fan mail. I mean, she does, you know, and she's so happy that I'm in. And then these titles are so ludicrous, you know. So I'm all for that magazine, which always gives me ideas and probably did help this chapter.
So what are some of the things you've learned to do and learned not to do as a filmmaker from watching porn films?
Well, my early films look terrible, but I didn't know what I was doing. I learned when I was doing it. I never went to film school. I didn't learn from porn or anything. I just learned how to turn on the camera. It was hard enough. But if you liked those films, you said they were primitive. If you hated them, you say you were amateurish. And it is the same word. And I gave a line to Cecil B. DeMenta, a film I wrote, where the character says, technique is nothing more than failed style. Which I believe. I believe if you come out of a movie and the first thing you say is the cinematography was beautiful, it's a bad movie.
Okay. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Waters, the filmmaker who made the famous films Pink Flamingos, as well as Hairspray, which became the basis of the musical Hairspray, and then the John Travolta remake of Hairspray. And he's written many books and does one-man shows, and his new book is called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. And the premise of this book is that he really hitchhiked across America, but there's also fictional chapters in it about what he imagines might go right and go wrong while he's hitchhiking. Let's get to the real thing, what really happened to you, John Waters, while you were hitchhiking cross country. And you write, can I really give up the rigid scheduling I'm so used to in my life? Me, the ultimate control freak who plans weeks ahead, the day I can irresponsibly eat candy? And I never thought that you were that much of a schedule, that you actually planned in advance the week you would eat candy.
I do. My hangovers are on my schedule 3 months in advance. I carry 4 pennies always in my pocket, so I'll never get more change.
Wow. That's actually very smart, but very, very planning ahead.
Yeah, I do plan ahead. I think I got that from my father.
It's certainly nothing I ever would have imagined from your early movies, that you would have been so kind of orderly and precise in your planning, because the movies are just like so transgressive and so like, if there's a boundary, I'm crossing it. I'm defying it.
But how could I have made all those movies on no money with my friends if I didn't plan? That can't happen magically. It happened because we were kind of obsessed. The same time, everybody said, oh, you must have been on drugs when you made those movies. No, we weren't on drugs when we made them. I was on drugs when I thought them up, and I was on drugs when we showed them. But I was never on drugs when we made them because it was too hard.
So, you know, another question you ask yourself is, what is the etiquette of hitchhiking? If a car stops, but if there's something you don't trust about the driver, do you politely decline the ride? Will you end up insulting the driver if you do that? Did you have to do that at all during your hitchhiking
trip? No, here's the thing. I wrote about that in the prologue, but when the real life, when you're out there, as I said, I would have gotten in Ted Bundy in his Volkswagen with his arm in a sling in the front seat. You'll get in any car. Believe me, all your rules, all your things that you imagine go out the window when you've been standing there for 10 years and those Kansas winds are ripping your weather-beaten face. It is the worst beauty regimen ever to hitchhike. I would go in the motels at night and look in the mirror. And I have in my office a little mirror, a hand mirror that I got from a joke shop where you pick it up and look at yourself and it screams. Well, that's what every mirror did when I hitchhiked across America. It let out a shriek of horror when they saw hitchhiking face, a new thing that I want to invent a product for. And I thought, no wonder people are picking me up, because I had a hat that said Scum of the Earth, which was a dumb fashion choice to take with me. It isn't a weird little exploitation movie I like, but I should not have worn that hat. But Pecker would have been worse. That was the other one I had. I thought that
another,
really
another movie
would be
title
a bad
of
one.
Yours, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of your rides, you got picked up in Myersville, Maryland by a 20-year-old Republican town councilman, and he drove you to Ohio. And it was a great ride. You call him in your book the Corvette Kid.
He was only going to lunch to get his lunch at the Subway shop when he stopped, and it was pouring rain and gave me a 4-hour ride, which was very nice.
And then you met up with him again, and he gave you an even longer ride.
Yes, he came back. He kept texting me, but I thought he was just kidding me that he wasn't going to come back. And finally, I got stuck in Ohio and Bonner Springs, Kansas. So it took a long while, and he kept texting me saying, I'm going to come get you again. I thought he was kidding. So I got a great ride with this Kansas couple who is coming to the signing in Baltimore, by the way. And they took me really a long way, all the way to Denver. And he wrote and said, what do you mean? I've been driving 48 hours at 80 miles an hour to catch up with you. And he finally did. And then took me to Reno, and then I just gave him the keys to my apartment and said, go stay in my place in San Francisco. And he was great. His parents were horrified, because if they Google me, it's not good. If you Google my name from a parent's viewpoint that your son is missing with in a car on the other side of the country, it is not comforting.
What comes up?
Well, you know, probably like battles for Manson family member parole. I just won some big gay award and Pink Flamingos. You know, none of it is nice for a parent to think, oh, great. Well, that'll be nice for him for summer. That's a good way to start the summer vacation.
So did the young Republican town councilman know your work? And what was his reaction when you described it?
He didn't know my work, and he did Google me on the way and saw at least it was true. I don't know to this day if he's ever seen my movies, but we certainly became friends. He stayed longer in San Francisco when we got there, and then he came to my Christmas party this year. I'm still in touch with him. I think it gave him confidence. He looked great. He looked great before, but we were just an odd couple. I mean, his friends were texting him saying, way to go, you're in Reno with a gay man in a motel. You know, that's great for your campaign, right? And we just laughed about it because it was so ridiculous. The whole thing was completely innocent. We, on the way, met some swingers that kept trying to hook up with us by texting him, which really left. In another hotel, the maitre d' came and knocked on his door in the middle of the night. I thought, hey, what about me? It was kind of funny. We just laughed the whole time.
One of the rides that you were really luckiest to get was a ride from an indie band, a band you'd never heard of, called Here We Go Magic. And apparently they weren't sure if it was really you or not, and they had a big debate about whether it was you, so they had to, like, spin around after passing you up just to see if it was really you or not. And so they picked you up. So that must have been great to be recognized and then to have an indie band driving you around. Did you know their music at all?
I didn't, and they're really good, by the way, too. So I certainly got their record, and it's really great. And, you know, it was just so nice to be with somebody in show business again, somebody that I didn't have to, you know, we compared stories about touring because I tour all the time, too. And they had been on tour for 2 years in this band. And I know. And in music today or in anything, if you Elton John goes every night and tours if he's not working. Bill Maher, the night he doesn't do a show, he's touring somewhere. And they all say, when you stop, it's over. You can't blink. So we were trading stories like that. And they were very helpful, so nice. And it was just, I felt every time I was in a car, I'd feel exhilarated until it got to the time when you had to get out. And then this great reality came back to you that you were out of your mind and you were actually doing this. It was no longer a book pitch. It was no longer an abstract idea. It was real. And that sound of the oncoming traffic, which still to this day has never left my system underneath all the soundtrack of my life.
So since Here We Go Magic picked you up, I thought we could hear a track of one of their songs. This is really catchy. It's called How Do I Know? This is Here We Go Magic.
How do I know if I love you when I show like your bread, the way that you tucker and straighten your bed? But how do I know?
So that's Here We Go Magic, the band that picked up John Waters. That sounded pretty good.
And wouldn't you like them to pick you up?
Yeah,
right, they sounded great.
Yeah, they could pick me up. And the next time I don't hitchhike.
So this didn't make you want to hitchhike one day. What's hitchhiking like in Philadelphia?
I wouldn't know. I never see anybody hitchhiking. My hitchhiking years ended decades ago.
Yeah, I know. Most people did. It's true. Yeah. In Baltimore, if you're hitchhiking, you're a hooker that doesn't have the internet. It's for the internet deprived.
So the members of the band, Here We Go Magic, tweeted that they'd picked you up, and their tweets went viral, and the New York Times called, and you know, one of the Baltimore papers called, and your office was doing this, like, We're not commenting. It's like, why wouldn't they?
I felt so.
Why wouldn't they confirm?
Kissinger.
Yeah, why can't they confirm that you were hitchhiking?
Because my rule before I started was that I was not going to ever confirm any of it till I got there. And I never did, because then it would have been, I'm giving interviews in people's car. That would be so rude. You know, I never once took out my phone and looked at my emails or anything in the car, because that's rude. Your job is to talk, and your job is to make friends with the people that have given you the hospitality of the little moving house they're in that you get to share. The more you talk, the longer they take you sometimes. So to me, sitting there and giving interviews would have been incredibly rude to the people that picked me up.
You write jokingly in your hitchhiking book that your idea for your next book might be, I retake every drug I ever took in order: hash, pot, LSD, amphetamine, morning glory seeds, glue, heroin, MDA, opium, mushrooms, cocaine. When I got to the heroin, I thought, what was that chapter of your life like? I mean, that's not...
Oh, I just did it a couple times. Now, I hated it because I didn't like sitting around nodding and puking. Ain't my idea of a good night, believe me. But the only one of all those ones you just described I would be scared to take again is morning glory seeds. You had to boil them for hours to get the poison off and then eat like 10 packs of them. And then you vomited. And then I hallucinated I was a canary, which isn't what you want to do when you're high. So it's not something I would do. And nowadays they took it. You can't do it. It doesn't work anymore. But for a while, we were hanging out in hardware stores looking for those morning glory seeds. So embarrassing. So low rent. Lower than glue.
Okay. Now, you're not really going to write this book, right? You retake every drug.
No, I don't think I am. I joked about it. No, I'm not going to write that book. Well, I don't think I am. No.
You've lost a lot of friends, I'm sure, you know, between drugs and AIDS and various other ways of death, probably some suicide.
All the things that hit the creative community, yes.
Yeah, right. So how does it feel to you to be hitting, you know, to be nearing 70, to be hitting a new decade in your life, thinking of how many people you know who never nearly got that far?
Well, I think I say that in the book. At one point, I'm standing there and I think, you know, I'm alive, and so many of my friends are not. I'm here. I'm doing this project. I'm alive. So I am incredibly thankful for my life. I said in this book that all my fantasies of what I wanted to happen in my career came true years ago. This is gravy. This is all better than I ever imagined it would happen. I've always been understood. I'm not like somebody that thinks I'm going to die and nobody got my work. I've had ups and downs in my career that have never been extreme, but I've always worked. And all my stuff is still out there. All the books I wrote are still in print. You know, the movies are available. They're on TV. Who could have ever imagined that those movies would be on television? So things have been good. So I think, you know, I'm an adult. God knows my mom died this year. My father died a couple of years ago. But they had great lives. It wasn't a tragedy. They lived to be 90. They had their mind right up to the very end. So I have had a very, very lucky life. But at the same time, I've loved my work, and that's a cliche, but it's really true. I jump out of bed every day to go to work, and it's not like I wake up and groan and think, oh, I have to go to the office. Now, the office is the room next to me that I have to go in and think up something weird. That's my job.
John Waters is the author of the new book, Carsick. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org.
Chicago, that's the last place my baby stayed.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.